Network. I am Rachel Cove. I am a published author, mother, and mental health advocate. I'm the co-owner of Transformational Solutions, which is a trauma-informed life coaching company that specializes in dealing with addiction, building emotional life skills, and personal development. And one of my new ventures that I'm very excited about is I am currently the co-host of the new weekly podcast called Kicking It with the Coves that I host with my twin brother, Jesse Cove, and my father, Martin Cove. I'm happy to be hosting for the first time by myself Answers Network, which brings you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to gaining greater health, joy, and love into our lives. As I'm sure many of you expected to hear Alan's voice this morning, we are reminded of the reality of what he does when he's not on the air. As a licensed international private investigator and crisis interventionist, he gets calls and has to respond very quickly. Be it locating a runaway, escorting a teen to a specialized program, breaking up a human trafficking ring, or retrieving an abducted child, whatever he's doing at this time, I really do wish him safety and success in his quest. Shows like this grow by listeners spreading the word. Its focus is on kindness, gratitude, personal empowerment, and sharing of information to make all of our lives better. You can help by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the show with your social media following. Now, I'm so excited to introduce today's incredible guest, who I've recently become a very huge fan of. Dr. Dean Walden is the author of Curing the Cancer in U.S. Healthcare and 11 other books, as well as more than 250 articles and monographs. After nearly 50 years as a pediatric cardiologist, educator, researcher, medical administrator, and public policy advisor, Dr. Dean is in a unique position to help readers break free of the nightmare we call our healthcare system. Dr. Dean studied medicine and trained at Yale, Chicago Medical School, Mayo Clinic, Northwestern, Harvard. Dr. Dean combines systems analysis and other management tools with the principles of good medical practice to diagnose and effectively treat sick systems such as healthcare. Dr. Dean Waldman, it's an honor to meet you.
And my pleasure to be here.
I'm very excited to have this conversation with you because I feel like I have become an overnight fan, and I'm so excited and honored to speak to you about your book. Can you please tell us what motivated you to write this book?
Sure. It's a somewhat long story, but I think your listeners will enjoy it. I found my niche in sort of life by becoming a pediatric cardiologist. I love kids. I'm very good with kids. They seem to connect with me. When I started in its infancy, and a lot of the children had these very complex heart problems, and frankly, many of them died. Over the course of my career, we went from a mortality rate of something like 30 or 40% to a mortality rate closer to 1% to 2% because of all the advances that we made over the last 40 years. And so that's really given me this great sense of satisfaction of working with kids, of doing well by children, of seeing children turn from blue babies into healthy, normal, running around teenagers, et cetera, et cetera. So I was very happy with my life, and yet I wasn't happy with my life. I figured, well, the problem is I was the chief of cardiology at the time at the University of Chicago. Well, maybe it's because I don't know how to be a chief. So, management planning and all this stuff. So I went back and I got my MBA. I was the oldest member of my class at 55 years of age. Anyway, so then I was still miserable. And I said, well, maybe I can use these skills that I learned in management school to figure out what's wrong with our healthcare system. And so I approached healthcare, the system, as though it were a sick patient. And instead of using an X-ray, I used a strategic matrix analysis. And instead of using blood studies, I did learning curve theory. And I did all these things to study what the problem with healthcare was, including the fact that the majority of my colleagues, nurses and doctors, were just as miserable as I was. If you talk to most care providers, they're very happy. They're very, and I learned why. The answer is this. Work, any kind of work, has two components. One is the work content, and the other is the work environment. Okay, the work content, whether you're a nurse in the ICU or you're me in the cath lab with some blue baby, I love doing that. I love helping people and doing good by them, if you forgive the phrase. We all hate the system in which we have to do this good work because the system makes our lives harder, not our lives easier. So that I got that. Then I said to myself, why does this system not work for either the nurses and the doctors or the patients? What's the reason the damn system? Well, I began to study that, and the long-term sort of long answer is this book. The book, Curing the Cancer in U.S. Healthcare, diagnoses patient healthcare, what's really wrong, not the symptoms, but the root cause. And once you know the root cause, you can turn around and say, oh, now that I know the root cause, if I deal with the root cause and not just treat symptoms, I can fix the patient, whether the patient is a blue baby or the patient is an adult with pneumonia or COVID, or the patient is patient healthcare. And so that's how I got to where I am.
Wow, it's so fascinating and so interesting. And I'm curious, how do you investigate the root cause?
You look at just the way I sort of implied it, but I'll just outright it. And we try to look at the hemoglobin and the white blood cell count and a bunch of liver functions and so forth. Well, I said, okay, what are the components, like the components of a body, a heart, a liver, a kidney, and so forth? Well, what are the components of the body called patient healthcare? Well, you got money, you got structures, you've got people, you've got regulatory systems, things of that nature that interconnect the money with the people and so forth. So I applied those management analysis tools to that. And the first thing I found, we'll just cut right to the chase. What I found was really very simple at its core. The root cause of all this stuff that doesn't work for you, me, and every patient in the United States, every person in the United States, because of what I'm going to say, is what disconnect is. A system has developed over the last 75 years. And I know this intimately because everybody in my family has been doctors for the last four generations. And I remember sitting, my grandfather wouldn't have been happy if he knew I was there, but I used to hide behind the couch in his study where he would talk to patients. And he had this direct connection. He talked to them. He knew their first names. He spent time listening to what their problems was, and they paid him. There was a direct connection between the doctor and the patient, and the doctor with the patient decided what to do, et cetera, et cetera. And now what we have is a disconnection. For example, the patient never pays me, ever. An insurance company or my medical center pays my salary, okay? I'm at a university hospital. So it pays my salary, not the patient. Patient doesn't open his wallet and give me money. Number two, I don't decide what medicines my patients get, or I shouldn't say that. I decide, then the insurance company says, no, you can't use that medicine because it's not on our formulary. You got to use this, which, oh, by the way, is cheaper. Okay, so we, the doctors and the patients, have been disconnected by this system. And that's why all of the doctors and nurses are frustrated, because we can't do what we know is right for the patient. And our work is not valued, at least not valued by the patient, because the patient doesn't pay us.
And in your book, and correct me if I'm wrong, you are trying to promote patient-centered system, correct?
Absolutely. The only system means the patient decides.
Wow. And that's
that simple.
It's interesting because the patient is coming to a doctor for a doctor to help them. So when you said, when you say a patient is there for the patient to decide, what do you mean by that?
I mean, okay, a patient comes to me, in my case, a baby. The mother brings the patient. The patient's got a hole in his heart. We need to fix that hole. We need to do it a certain way. We need to do it at a certain time. We used to need to use certain people and equipment and so forth. Okay. In my judgment, that's the best way to do what this patient needs. Now, the insurance company turns around and says, no, you can't operate on that patient then. We're going to wait 6 weeks or 3 months for authorization for this. No, institution, even though I think that's the best place to operate for that child. No, you can't use that medicine because we won't allow you to use that medicine. It's not on our formulary, even though I know that's the best medicine for that child. So we're back to saying, I don't really decide, or should I say, the patient doesn't decide with my advice what the thing to do for either themselves or for their babies, their children, because the system has disconnected the two of us.
I see. So from what I'm hearing you say, it sounds like the system is what is in charge of the patient's health.
Number one, that's true. Number two, here comes the other really bad part. We spend way too much money. We, the United States, we won't get to the, we'll get to the patients in a second. We spend way too much money on healthcare, and everybody knows that, and everybody agrees with that. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. Everybody agrees we're spending $4 trillion. That's the gross domestic product of Germany we're spending on a healthcare system. Here's what's really scary. Half of that goes to the system and doesn't provide any care for patients. So I sit and I look at my data, you know, when I did all this financial analysis, and went, are you telling me that I, as a physician, am denied the use of $2 trillion in the care of my patients? Well, when I say my, I mean every doctor in the United States. And the answer is, yeah, that's right. It goes to pharmacy benefit managers. It goes to accountants. It goes to billers, coders, managers, consultants, on and on and on. But the half of all the money and close to 80% of all healthcare workers provide no care. So I say, well, imagine that that money either stayed in taxpayers' wallets or was actually spent on care providing, on getting to the hospital on time rather than having an appointment that you can get 6 months from now to see a doctor because you have an abdominal pain. Operating at the hospital that is the right place for your baby to be operated on, or yourself or your father or whoever. Okay. Right is decided by the patient, right place, in association with the doctor, instead of an employee of the insurance company.
I actually have, may I share with you a personal story? So my stepdad, who unfortunately he passed away, but when he was fighting cancer, before he had cancer, he had pneumonia. And he coded blue in the hospital, and he was in the ICU, and the doctors brought him back to life. And the doctors had recommended that he go into rehab, and he was denied by the insurance company.
Sure.
And it was, I remember my mother, and my mother's a very strong, assertive woman. And eventually we were able to get him the help that he needed. And eventually the insurance company was able to pay for the services. But my fight back, the help that he needed. And I just wonder how many people are going through that same experience.
And the answer is a huge number, number one. Number two, there was a study that came out a few years ago, 5 years ago, about the VA, and I quote the conclusion, 47,000 U.S. veterans may have died waiting in line for care.
Yes, I actually have that pulled up on my screen right now because I did not want to forget that number because that is a crucial number for people to know.
And the answer is this is not because we don't know how or we don't have the technology to provide that care. It's because the system stalls the actual provision of that care. It, the system, makes money by delayed, what I call the 3D fence, which delay. You talk about your stepfather. I had a patient, I don't remember whether this is in the book or not, but I had a patient who needed a certain medication. And she, we had done a heart transplant. She was 11 months old. No, 10 months old. She needed a certain medication, an anti-rejection medication. So I wrote a prescription, and the pharmacy then called after the patient went to pick it up. No, we can't. This is not approved by the insurance company. Make a long, very painful story short, it took me 2 days to get to the insurance company medical director. I finally got a hold of him. Make a long story short, he said, no, no, you have to use this other drug, which is used in adults, doesn't work in children. He said, that's our approved anti-rejection medication. It's what you have to use. And I said, I'm not going to use that. It's the wrong medication for my patient. Well, it's too bad, Dr. Waldman, but that's the only one we authorize. If you want the other one, which was like something like $500 a month or something like that, the charge, not the actual cost, but the charge. This is a poor Spanish family. They probably had a total income of $500 a month, which they would have spent on her if they could have. But make a long story short, after yelling and screaming, I hung up and I thought, I got to do this a different way. So I sat and I thought and I had some coffee and I thought, and then I called him back and I said, okay, fine. If you don't want to pay for that, that's just fine. I recommend that you watch the 11 o'clock news tonight. Oh, why, said he. I said, because Carla Aragon, who is this very nice lady who is the anchor for 11 o'clock news, in San Diego, 11 o'clock news, and she's going to have a little interview with me, and I'm going to explain how your insurance company is going to kill my patient after her transplant because she can't get the right anti-rejection medication. So we just spent $150,000 to $200,000 on the operation. And now you're going to throw that money away, not to mention the minor little detail, her life, by denying her the medication that she needs. So look at the 11 o'clock news. It was silence for probably not more than 20, 30 seconds. And he said, all right, let me get back to you. I'll get you an approval. And that was now the point is, sure, my patient got the thing. The medication. But the real issue is if I didn't have that kind of connection, then the patients aren't getting what they need because the insurance companies are determining the medical care or drug care, whatever it is, rather than the patient with the doctor's advice.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think about everything that you're expressing because I'm also looking at it from the angle of the time constraint that doctors have with their patients, correct? And that's something that you discussed a lot in your book, that there is limited time. Can you speak to that?
You're talking about of limited time of the doctor or time to get the care? Well, we'll talk about both. Number one.
Yeah.
If we talk, one of the problems that has arisen and it took me a while to figure this out. Once I figured it out, again, it's one of these very obvious things. We applied management tools to healthcare, thinking that would improve the system. The problem is the word efficiency. Mm. Efficiency means the best use of the limited resources you have available to accomplish the goal that you want. So if you're making cars, you want to spend the least amount of money you can spend to make the most value in terms of what the patient, no, sorry, what the buyer wants in a car. But the key is for efficiency, you use the least money to get the most value for the product. In healthcare, the product we want is healthy people. It is not saving money. And so when you look at a doctor, for example, myself, use myself, according to the benchmarks for efficiency by which I am judged, I'm supposed to see 4.2 established patients an hour. That means I'm supposed to see a patient that I already know every 14 minutes. I'm supposed to do a history, a physical, diagnose the problem, talk to the family, explain what the problem is, discuss the medications or surgery or whatever the child needs. In 14 minutes, with all due respect, it takes me 10 minutes just to play with the child on the floor before the child will let me even approach him, touch him, examine him or her. So this efficiency thing has taken away the time that we need to spend, that the patients expect to spend. Turn it around for adults. An adult comes to see a physician. The adult wants to talk to the doctor. They don't want the doctor looking at his watch going, oh, well, what? Time's up. They don't want the doctor spending most of his time. And this is the commonest complaint. My doctor didn't look at me. All he did was look at a computer screen.
Yes. Can I share my own personal story again?
Please.
So I had cancer when I was 16 and I was very lucky to survive. And I had melanoma. And I was an avid soccer player my whole life until I was 21. And so I was in the sun a lot. And unfortunately, it developed into a significant melanoma. And so I'm routinely getting checked yearly to make sure that the cancer isn't back. And I've also had a baby. And there's just been, you know, a lot of time spent in hospitals. And I, too, have felt that way, this feeling of like I'm being kind of hurried along.
That's right.
An appointment, or kind of like I'm a burden. And again, I actually, now hearing you, it makes me have more compassion for the doctors. Whereas before I might've felt frustrated, because I do think we have to start looking at health as a holistic piece, like how many things are influencing these symptoms or the root cause, right? So there's not enough time.
One of the things, and we'll get to actually the solution, but I can give you a little foreshadowing, and you saw this in the book. One of the things that is striking about what's known as concierge care or direct pay care, or call it whatever you like, but it's a system where the doctor and the patient are connected. The patient pays the doctor knows the patient on a first name basis. And what every single patient and doctor says is, oh God, thank you. I have time to talk to my patient. I'm not being rushed by some efficiency expert saying, your benchmark, time's up. You got to go to the next patient because you got to be efficient. You have to hit your benchmark number of patients. No, it's not number of patients. It's the health and welfare of each individual patient. And so if you talk to concierge doctors, they'll all, to a person, say, yeah, thank God. I'm probably making maybe the same amount of money, maybe a little less, but I have time to spend with Mrs. Jones. Nobody's rushing me through. Mm-hmm. And the key there is the direct connection of doctor and patient. The doctor decides and advises, and the patient pays the doctor. I'm back. That's one of my, I'm going to say that again and again until people begin to believe me. And sooner or later in this interview, you've got the issue of it's going to turn around pretty much everybody, unless you're in the fraction of 1% of the population. Everybody's going to say, oh, I can't afford to pay for my health care, right?
Right. I mean, that's part of the problem.
Okay. Now, can we talk about that right now?
Can we please talk about that right now?
Yeah. You bet. All right.
Okay, great.
This is 2022. The latest data I actually have is 2020, not 2021. 2020, the average American family spent $28,166 on healthcare costs. Okay?
Can you repeat that one more time?
$28,166 on healthcare costs, of which 80% went to insurance companies.
Wow. So that how many are being, I just wonder, are paying to be covered by insurance?
That is insurance that they pay, insurance premiums that they pay, insurance that the employer pays, that the employer could give them money if the tax code allowed. That is co-pays, deductibles, and so it is a total amount of money coming out of the average family's pocketbook, partly from the employer-supported contributions, then the family-paid contributions, and then all those deductibles and those co-pays. You add all that up, and the average American family spent $28,000. Now, my solution is very simple and straightforward. Instead of $8,000, put it in a health savings account. The health savings account, by the way, has to become immortal. That is, you can't, no use it or lose it. You can build it up over years so that if you're healthy this year and you put in $28,000 and you only use $4,000, then you got $24,000 that rolls over to next year and so forth and such. If I had the money that I gave Medicare over my working lifetime, I'd have something like $250,000 to $300,000 in an HSA, which, of course, I do not because the law doesn't allow it. And now, oh, well, wait a minute. What if, you know, your father has a heart attack or, you know, you have melanoma, which is expensive care back when you were a child? Catastrophic deductible insurance, and otherwise pay for your care out of your HSA. That directly connects the doctor with the patient, that cuts all of this middleman waste, $2 trillion of middleman waste out of the system and puts it back in the patient's pockets. It's that simple, and it's that unacceptable to the people in Washington, because what I'm proposing is to cut all of Washington and all of their people that they support out of the healthcare system and reconnect the doctor with a patient, which, of course, now I need to say, I probably would have forgotten this. That book, which I encourage everybody to read that you liked,
I didn't like
general public. It is easy to read. It's got some fun stories and all sorts of good things in there. I did not read this, write it for the people in Washington, because I know they will hate it. They will say, wait a minute, you want to take control away from me and give it to somebody else? That somebody else being the patient. Yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. And so this book was not written for policy experts and for congressmen and senators and all these people. It was written for you and your twin brother and your next door neighbor, so that we, the people, and I like to call us we, the patients, we, the people, can advocate. Now, here's the way to do it, in my opinion. Well, you know, Washington has too much control and they can't. No, let's stop for a second. Washington currently thinks they have control, but I would remind us that we have the ballot and we need to use the ballot. And the way we do it is A, by electing people who are willing to listen to what I'm saying, and B, do it at the state level. Now, the reason I say the state level is very important. Most people in this country actually know their state representative. That representative lives four doors down. You see him at the shopping center, maybe not in New York City, but pretty much everywhere else. the person is known to his neighbors and is connected and is responsive to his constituency. I have never talked in any state I've been in. I have literally never talked to senator or representatives everywhere that I've been. And that's true of most people. I spent a lot of time, I was advising the state of Texas for a number of years on healthcare policy. Those representatives, they know all of them, well, not all, most of their constituents on a first name basis. So you turn around and you say to your state representative, I want you guys to lobby to get our state out from under Washington. I want you to get rid of Medicaid entirely, which, by the way, is the largest single budget item of every state in the United States of America. The state's number one expense is the money they pay Washington. Now, that's direct taxpayer dollars that go to Washington, and then Washington turns around and gives a fraction of that back to the state. Don't do that. Just say, people, we're going to let them decide, the people that have enough money to put in $28,000, they put it in. The impoverished, we're going to create a safety net. All that stuff is in the book, as I'm sure you read. There are several ways to create safety nets, and we actually had good ones until Obamacare. And get Washington out of healthcare. That's why the subtitle of this book is called States Care. It is not Obamacare. It's not Trump Care. It's not Waldman Care. It's not Hillary Care. It is the people in a state. You are in California? Fine. If Californians really want a single-payer system, which I personally think is a mistake, but that's their choice. That's your decision. Washington shouldn't tell you how to run a system for 39 million who live in California. You should decide. If Montana wants or Texas wants the system that I suggest, which is market-based medicine, which basically gives total control to the patient, then in that case, they should be free to do that. And Washington should tell nobody what they should do with healthcare. And that will play very well to the state representatives. It will play very poorly to Congress.
Wow. It's a lot to digest and to take in and to think about. And something that you wrote in the book that I thought was very interesting that I hadn't heard before, which was, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Russell Acuff.
Acuff,
I'm sorry. And he talked about, can you talk about that, how to fix a problem, the four ways to fix a problem? Because I just thought that was really interesting.
Russ Acuff, kind of fixing things and so forth, should read his book called Acuff's Best. He was a brilliant, truly brilliant management advisor for Fortune 500 companies, for hospitals, for a bunch of people. One of the things he said was, okay, there are four ways to fix a problem. And I'm glad you brought this up. The first way is to absolve the problem. I don't know if he called it, but I call it the four solves.
Yes.
You can absolve the problem and just say, it's okay. Well, you know, we'll live with it. It's, you know, we'll forget it. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
That's absolving a problem, the first solve. The second solve is solving a problem. Well, you put some pans under where the roof leaks, and you solve the problem, but you make it a little better. The third one is to resolve the problem, which is to make it the best it can be. So you plug the holes in the roof. Mm. Okay, but the real solution is what he calls dissolve, D-I-S-S-O-L-V-E, dissolve the problem, which means you address the root cause of the problem. Now, the root cause of your problem with a leaky roof is that you got an old roof that keeps wearing out. So there are two choices here. One, you can replace the entire roof in which with something that won't wear out, or two, you can move to someplace that doesn't rain. Either way, you dissolve the root cause of the problem, which is water getting into your house. I say the same thing about healthcare. People say, well, you know, the symptoms are we spend too much money and we don't get quality care. I mean, those are the two basic problems, symptoms. And those symptoms are valid. Symptom complaints are valid. So you could say, well, and they'll just spend more money. Well, okay, that's not going to solve it because half of the money goes to the system and not to the providers. Or, well, we want quality care. Well, who decides quality?
Right.
Does the insurance company decide quality? Does the federal government decide quality? Or do you, the patient, when you go buy a sweater, you decide the value calculation, how much I'm willing to spend for what level of quality sweater I want. That's a decision you make. You should make the same decision in healthcare. Namely, I have $28,000, $50,000, whatever dollars in my HSA because I've put it away of $28,000 the last 2 years. So I got 50 grand in there and I need a hernia repair. Well, there are three hospitals that my doctor says do well with hernia repairs. So I will look at hospital A and see what their price is and what their results are and how long until I can get the hernia repair. Same thing for hospital B. Same hospital C, and then
so it sounds like what you're saying is to spend time educating the patients and providing them with options to empower them to choose how they best want to help themselves.
That's exactly right. The problem that comes up with that, there are two problems. One isn't a problem, but I'll bring it up. People say, oh, well, healthcare is much too complex for people to shop for their own care. I mean, this is such a complex system. Well, yeah, it is a complex system. But the actual provision of care is not complex at all. It is, I've got a hernia. Well, somebody's got to operate on that or do something to fix my hernia. I understand what the hernia is. It's a weakness in the lower abdominal wall. And so these are my options. I've discussed it with my doctor. The complaint that I get, the complaints I'm proposing here, excuse me, if you're a poor family in this country and your total income is $30,000 a year or $40,000 a year, which is well below the median, you're a great shopper. You're not a good shopper. You know what value is. And if you have a safety net that allows you to spend a certain amount of money on care, you'll go and spend that money very wisely. So that whole business is just full of it, in my opinion. The poor are great shoppers. The rich can afford to say, you know, whatever the price, I don't really care. But if you're making a subsistence level amount of money and you're still alive, you're a damn good shopper. So I don't buy this business, oh, the patient can't shop for care. Now, the other one, which didn't, we're already getting it, a resistance from both the providers and the hospitals, the institutions, because they don't want to compete with each other. The hospitals don't want to let you know. I mean, they're already fighting federal laws about releasing what the true costs are for a hernia repair or open heart surgery or whatever it is. They're fighting it. They're going to lose this battle, I hope, but they're fighting it. Well, in my system, they don't have a choice. Either they compete with each other for the patient's dollars, or they don't compete with each other, in which case the patient's going to go somewhere else.
Wow. It's a lot to think about. And there's definitely needs to be some different solutions, which I highly recommend. You really provide anyone that's interested in hearing more solutions. I highly recommend you getting Dr. Waldman's book. I wanted to quickly, because we're almost out of time, but I wanted to share a question that one of our listeners had, as well as a comment. Sure. When Obamacare was launched, I was a single parent with two children in high school. I kept my boys insured, but just could not afford insurance for myself. I'm absolutely going to buy your book, as I'm so upset over the corruption in our medical system, and we need drastic change sooner rather than later, and the total elimination of greedy pharmaceutical companies and hospitals influencing and controlling healthcare. Oh, it made me emotional thinking about that, because I'm also a single mom, so I understand the pressure around that, and it's overwhelming, and it's stressful, and I think that's part of the issue. Is we already have so much stress being alive and being human in this world, and this is it's a problem.
Was there a question from her?
There was no question from her, so that was just the comment. The next one is a question. Well, do you have anything that you'd like to say?
Yes,
to that?
I'd like to respond. Yeah. Obamacare gave insurance, government provided insurance to roughly 16.7 million Americans. At the same time, 7 million Americans actually lost their private insurance through Obamacare. The problem is this. Obamacare spent, depends on whose numbers you believe, but roughly $1.76 trillion, almost all of which went to the system, insurance companies, regulators, federal agencies, overseers, and not to the nurses and doctors. So number two, times for a patient to see a physician went up, not down. So what good is insurance if you can't use it to see the doctor in a timely fashion? So the answer is, they gave insurance, but the insurance was worthless. And more important, people did not get timely care. And oh, by the way, we spent a truckload of money. So when people start talking about Medicare for All, which is a gigantic Obamacare, you're going to spend $40 trillion, according to Bernie Sanders, whose plan it is, and you're going to get even less care than you're getting now. This is a mistake to increase the government's role in healthcare. We need to decrease that care.
And we're almost out of time, so I want to let you hear this other question. And again, thank you for everything you're saying is so valuable and so important. And I know you're helping so many people with your experience and your expertise around this. So someone asked, cancer and heart disease killed my father and five of my closest uncles and aunts, most of them passing in their 50s or early 60s. I chose a healthier, non-smoking lifestyle early with organic foods and a natural way of living. Having just turned 73, my physical condition and overall health is superior to most 40-year-olds. We have an overabundance of research, and yet our kids are fed junk food and sugar. What is your opinion about a medical education where doctors have little to no training on nutrition or prevention of disease outside treating it with pills? Wow, I wish I asked this earlier, because this is such a long response.
We could spend an hour on this. Exactly. And we, right, not 99 or 95. Most of my colleagues think that we need to fix the patient's problem with pills, surgery, whatever, rather than advise the patient how, A, to avoid the problem
with
rather
prevention
than fixing the problem. It made me crazy. My wife will tell you, it made me crazy when I would come home at night and I'd say to her, yeah, first patient came in 8:30 in the morning, mother with child, and the child had for breakfast Coke and Cheetos.
Yep. Hot Cheetos. That's what I was served in middle school, was hot Cheetos. It's like they want us to be addicted to sugar.
I wanted to shake these people and say, have you ever heard of an apple?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So Dr. Waldman, where can people get your book? Where can people find you if they want to learn more information about what you're teaching, what you're writing about?
The answer is Amazon is probably the best place, much as I have questions about supporting Amazon. But, you know, they make the book readily available. It's very inexpensive. It's a fun, easy read. I encourage people to read it. I have a website, which is deanwaldman.com. That's Dean with an E. My mother did that to me 78 years ago, and I've been paying for it ever since. It's DeanWaldman. So it's just www.deanwaldman.com. And I got a whole bunch of stuff on the website so that people can read for themselves. There's actually a chapter of the book in there. There's all sorts of good stuff in there. A lot of actually fun graphics. That's one of the things I put in the book, was graphics to lighten what is a very cartoons and so forth, to lighten what is a very serious subject.
That's what I really enjoyed about your book, that it's a very serious subject, but it was very digestible and it was easy to understand what you were saying. Because it is a very complex, complicated issue. And yet I felt when I was reading it, it made sense very quickly to me, which isn't always the case when I read books. So I appreciate the way
you put it. I will tell you that was actually very hard for me, because as you started in the interview, I have published certainly 150 to 200 purely medical articles in medical journals and so forth. And there's a certain way that you write, and it is bloodless. It is not human. It is not, you don't try and connect with your reader. You simply give the reader data information. Write a book for the general public was actually very hard for me. And I had to work really a lot of hours to include all these stories and to make the complex stuff really fairly straightforward and simple. And I don't think I oversimplified it, but as you enjoyed the book, and a lot of other people have said the same thing, you know, this is actually a pretty fun, easy read. So that's why I encourage everybody to read it, so they can think for themselves when our Washington people say, oh, we're going to do this for you, or we're going to do that for you. No, I want to do we for me.
Oh, Dr. Waldman, what an honor and a privilege to meet you. I'm so excited to come out to New Mexico and meet you in person.
My pleasure.
All of our listeners, please, if you're interested in getting his book, you can get it on Amazon. Again, our Answers Network, joined by Richard A. Green, author of Agents of Deceit, The True Story of Life Inside Today's Chaotic and Dysfunctional IRS. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or subscribe to our show through iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble. Wow, lots of ones
everywhere.
Everywhere. And people have also been asking me where they can listen to Kicking It with the Coves podcast. It's available on Apple, Spotify, and Podcast One. It's a weekly episode on Thursdays. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I hope everyone has a really great day. And again, thank you so much, Dr. Waldman.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.